Oh, yeah, Sunday.
Because you have your house here by me, right?
Yeah, we live in Charlestown. So I used to live in Cambridge. Couldn't take it. It's the Boston Navy Yard, if you've ever been over there, where the Constitution is.
Oh, maybe I have seen that once.
Yeah, it's a very nice area to live.
That's great. So how long have you ever talked to you without the cue?
I think a half hour, 40 minutes, and then I'll have lots of slides that people, I mean, I can go into quite a lot of detail, depending on people's interest and endurance and whatever. And we don't have to fill the time. I'm not a political scientist, so I don't feel I have to fill the time.
Great, I think, shall I make a quick introduction?
Sure.
I think we can start now. Great. Hi, everyone. I'm Abel. I'm a senior here at the college. I'm currently president of Harvard College Peace Action, and we're organizing this event. We're very happy that Professor Postol can join us here today. I want to point out, Harvard College Peace Action, we're a group of students here on campus trying to raise awareness about the dangers of war, and nuclear war in particular. So if you're interested in getting involved in our events, we have a sign-up sheet in the back. And we'll have a meeting this Tuesday evening, so you can sign up for the mailing list and we can keep you up to date on that. Just a brief introduction for Professor Postol. So he's the Professor Emeritus of Science, Technology, and International Security at MIT. He has a graduate degree in nuclear engineering and went on to work at the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment, I think primarily on the MX missile system. And after that, Professor Postol went on to be the scientific advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations, and since then has become a very prominent critic of various weapon systems, in particular missile defense systems, one of the most important voices, I think. So we're very excited to have you speak. I think, you know, especially now that the Obama government is spending $1 trillion over the next 30 years upgrading or so-called modernizing the nuclear arsenal. I'm not sure if you're going to agree with that term. So just a quick note about the format of today. So Professor Postol will speak for about 30, 40 minutes, so we have a lot of time afterwards for Q&A. And I heard he has a lot of slides, so I'm sure it will be a very productive Q&A. So just a brief word about the co-sponsors. So the Harvard Russian Speakers Association here at Harvard is co-sponsoring this event. So we're very happy with that. And Mass Peace Action and United for Justice with Peace also. Thanks a lot for helping to make this happen. I also wanted to announce that due to a very unfortunate scheduling accident, for which I very much apologize, Professor Elaine Scarry will be talking at the Central Square Library at 7 p.m. Today. So there will be enough time to all go to that talk together. So it'll be very good, full day of peace talks, so it's great. So thanks again very much for being able to be here with us, and very much look forward to hearing what you have to say.
I hope it'll
thanks.
Be good.
Thanks.
It's interesting. My joke with my wife is that the planets follow Ptolemaic epicycles around Harvard Square, and people generally think of it as the center of the universe, and here we are with roughly 20 people in a room talking about the potential cataclysmic existential annihilation of the human race. So maybe it's a statement about where our society is these days. The question I'm going to raise here today is whether or not there's the danger of an accidental nuclear war between the United States and in Russia, with Russia in particular, although there are many other possibilities, is higher today than it was during the Cold War. I think the answer to this question is unknowable, and in spite of some quantitative little tricks people sometimes use to explain why these dangers are high, I don't think any quantitative method can give us any insight. But I believe that there's a lot of qualitative information that points strongly to the conclusion that the danger of nuclear war is now considerably higher than it was during most of the time we call the Cold War. The reasons for this are both immediate and historic. If we are to reduce the chances of an event that could well result in the complete destruction of the world we know, we need to confront and understand why we are now in our current predicament so we can begin to find ways to back out of it or to get away from the brink. I will focus here on the technical aspects of this dangerous situation, but there are also political dimensions to it, and I just, you can't talk about one without the other, although my focus will be on the technical. On the political side, the political relationship between Russia and the United States has been spiraling downward and amazingly continues to spiral downward, creating tensions that are higher than at most times during the Cold War. All you have to do is read a newspaper any day, and whether you're talking about the situation in South Korea with China, which is really related to what's been going on elsewhere, or the deployment of troops to the border, near the borders of Russia, after there was a 1997 agreement that we would never do that, because the troops that we deploy are going to be, they're not going to be permanent, they're going to be, the people are going to be moved in and out, like that doesn't happen in Afghanistan, they stay there forever, you know, there's no moving in and out of forces. So, this downward spiral has sort of become more obvious. It's been going on for quite a while. I've been in this business for quite a while, and during the 25 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union, I have despaired time and time again by actions of the United States. But it was really brought to the forefront by the unwise decision of Russia, after being subjected to hostile American actions for 25 years, of taking some actions with regard to the Ukraine. I'm not saying they weren't provoked. I think they were substantially provoked, but it still wasn't a good idea. And nor was it a good idea for the United States to provoke them as strongly as we did with NATO expansion and all this discussion about how the Ukraine, this country with no serious problems at all, would be another great democracy entering NATO. So the situation is really much like the situation that people talk about when they talk about the Treaty of Versailles after World War I, that many people ascribe to the creating circumstances that fed the revival of Germany toward taking actions that eventually led to World War II. I don't think it's that simple, but there's a lot of action and reaction here, none of which is good. So with these points in mind, I'm going to really focus on the technical. And I'm going to talk about the theory of nuclear war fighting, fighting and winning a nuclear war. And I'm going to point out that the preparations to fight a war taken by the United States, because the United States is, in fact, definitely taking preparations to fight and win a nuclear war. Incidentally, I don't think that this is the policy. I don't think this is a concealed policy. I don't think that this is a secret desire of even our own military people. I think this is a sort of bureaucracy gone mad and a catastrophic failure of political leadership, which you don't have to debate about when you look at this particular problem, because you can see what's happened in other areas. So I'm not saying that this is the intent. But the potential adversary, in this case Russia, which has substantial nuclear forces, cannot ignore what is going on here. They have to, their military has the job of providing for the defense of their country and providing military capability should they be asked to use it. That's the job of all militaries in highly developed nations. That's the job of our military. Our military does things that it doesn't think are particularly wise because they're told to do it. And the really good military officer will advise against it, but when they're ordered, they'll salute and do their job. So what I'd like to do is give you a sense of the issues that come up when you think about fighting and winning a nuclear war. First of all, you can be sure, absolutely sure, that every step we take is being watched and analyzed at the highest levels of detail by the Russian military. For sure. I have had interactions with many Russian military over the years. I've had interactions with many of the political leadership. And these people are very smart. They're very concerned. And I used to think, I used to argue with them that they're acting paranoid. But frankly, I no longer do that because I think a lot of their reaction to certain actions from the West are not entirely unreasonable. And there's a very interesting article in the Washington Times just today, I was sent a copy of it, talking about the extreme reaction in the Russian public toward American, toward the United States now. So one of the objectives of fighting and winning a nuclear war, in fact, the main objective, is to prevail by having more forces left than the adversary. That's the definition. In other words, I want to be able to win the war by having more military capacity than you do when I'm finished. I destroy enough of your military capacity that I then have the freedom of action to do what I want. Take over your country, annihilate your country, put a new government into your country, defeat other forces that you have because they're no longer strong enough to put me on, you know, to take me on. So that's the definition. Now, of course, this definition is ridiculous, because the nature of nuclear weapons are that they are so powerful that a very small residual from this force that you have tried to annihilate can essentially end your country, not just your society, just eliminate your country. So the definition ignores a fundamental truth, and I say it's fundamental. This is the physical world that you live in, is that you can never deny your adversary the option to say, okay, I've lost this war by this peculiar definition you have forced on me, but I'm going to make sure that you pay the ultimate price just as I'm paying the ultimate price. So that's what makes this whole business of war fighting so ridiculous. So what I'm going to do first is just to get this off the table as for purposes of argument, I'm going to just show you what would happen if a single Russian warhead from a class of missile known as the SS-18 were to explode over Boston, just to give you a feel for the levels of damage. Then I'll go back into talking about nuclear war fighting. A subject, incidentally, I should say, while I was in the Pentagon, I did a lot of work on this. So, I mean, I know the arguments very well, and I'm happy to lay them out for you and whatever insane detail makes you comfortable. Okay, so let's see if my slides will change. No, my computer seems to be dead. This is really not a good thing. Something here. Oh, good. Okay, what this first slide just shows you Boston, the skyline of Boston. I've chosen to take a perspective from roughly over the Harvard campus, just because we all know the areas, get a sense of distance. And so for those of you who were looking downtown, here's the downtown area. And there's Harvard Football Stadium, Elliott House, Harvard Square, and Harvard Yard. So this is what I've designated here is a ground zero. Or what a ground zero is, it's a location on the ground over which a nuclear weapon can be detonated. So the ground zero could be, it could be actually at the ground, or as I'll show you for this case, it could be in the air over a particular point on the ground. And there are reasons for choosing what's called a height of burst. And I'll explain you as I discuss the consequences of this detonation. It'll become more obvious to you. So what I'm doing is I'm choosing a height of burst for the SS-18 warhead, equivalent, scaled appropriately to the height of burst that was chosen for the attacks on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. For this much larger weapon, it's a 800 kiloton weapon. The weapon that destroyed Nagasaki was about 22 kilotons. the weapon that destroyed Hiroshima was about 12 and a half. So this is a very big weapon relative to those weapons. And this line, dotted line, shows you the size of the fireball. Let me just give you a little bit of. Okay, now, it's very important for you to get a sense of what is meant by a fireball, because it's nothing like what you think unless you have studied this on your own. This is not just a ball of hot gas that is generated by the expansion of gases like occurs in a conventional explosion. A conventional explosion, you have a very rapid chemical reaction, in this case through a detonation wave, a shock wave, which is a particular kind of a very fast chemical reaction, where you convert the solid materials to gas. The gas violently expands outward, creates a shock wave. In this case, what happens is you have this nuclear device, which initially is, of course, dormant, and then when the detonation process begins, it is assembled, or it is triggered. And in the initial phases of peak energy output, the temperature in the interior of this device will reach maybe 100 million degrees Kelvin. So the temperature in the center of the sun is 20 million degrees Kelvin. So this is quite hot. And because the temperature is so enormous, of course, most of the energy is not in the form of recoiling matter. It's actually in the form of light, photons, in this case, X-rays. Now, the X-rays, because the X-rays are associated with a high temperature, like red hot is associated with a temperature, white hot is associated with temperature. You go to millions of degrees, you get X-rays. That's the wavelength of electromagnetic radiation that's associated with those temperatures. These X-rays are not transparent to the air. The air absorbs them very efficiently. So you initially get, within the first, let's say, millionths of a second, you get a ball of superheated air. It's already maybe cooled to a million degrees from 100 million. 100 million is at the center of the weapon. There's no movement of mass at all because it happened so fast. Even though the air is super hot, it hasn't had a chance to expand outward. And so it just sits there for a short interval of time, several millionths of seconds. And then, of course, momentum takes over because there's so much pressure in this superheated ball of gas. And it initially expands out at millions of miles per hour, but it slows down as the bubble expands. And what you eventually get is a bubble of superheated air. In this case, the bubble has taken about 1.5 seconds or so to grow to its size of roughly a mile diameter. And it's cooled dramatically to maybe 8,000 degrees Kelvin. Surface of the sun is 6,000 degrees Kelvin, so it's somewhat hotter than the equivalent area of the surface of the sun. So one simple way that is not too misleading to think of this is as a piece of the sun that has been brought down to the earth and is just giving off its energy for a short interval of time, a few tens of seconds or whatever, because the fireball is cooling. So if you were at, let's say, this range from the nuclear detonation here at Harvard, there would be no shockwave at this point. It takes the shockwave time to arrive. What you would observe, though, is black smoke and things bursting into flames from the heat from the fireball. The fireball would appear maybe more than 1,000 times brighter than a desert sun at noon. Some of you may be aware there was a classic book written, Brighter Than 1,000 Suns. That turns out to be a physically accurate statement as well as a literary statement. And the light and heat from the fireball would be so intense that buildings would be catching on fire. If people were caught in the street, their clothes would ignite along with their skins being burned to really just being burnt off them. But that's only part of the action. As the weapon continues, A shock wave is generated by the rapid expansion of the fireball. Think of the fireball as acting like a fast-moving piston against the surrounding air. When the fireball reaches its maximum size, it's very hot. The density of air inside it is less than 1% of the density of the atmosphere, the normal atmosphere, because all this air has just gotten diluted as PV is equal to RT. And so as this fast-moving piston pushes against the surrounding air, it generates a shock wave of enormous power and extent. So first, the shock wave breaks away from the fireball, and there's some very beautiful photographs of this kind of breakaway phenomenon. If you know what you do, if you're crazy enough to do things like I do, where you're very intensely interested in the actual phenomenology, and then eventually the shock wave, of course, propagates outward, and you get a reflected shock off the ground that will propagate out behind the primary shock. And by adjusting the height of burst, as was done at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you can maximize the range at which a given maximum overpressure occurs. So you can get a certain level of damage over the largest area possible. If you detonate much lower, you'll get much more damage on the ground locally, but won't go as far out. This is not a fantastically large effect, but people use it. Burst of height, I mean, the joke is, give me the latitude, longitude, and height of burst, because that tells you what level of damage I'm trying to do to something. And so in the case of Hiroshima, the height of burst was adjusted, so roughly 50, the area that would be covered with a blast of roughly 15 pounds per square inch was maximized. So the fireball, the shockwave, of course, will continue to propagate outward. And so some of you, if you've ever seen any of these films about the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the planes that drop the bomb are trying to outrace the shockwave, and they get hit by a shockwave. There's some fairly good dramatizations of this now. And then there's a second shock that they get hit with a few seconds later, and that's the reflected shock. And this was all well known and understood. Now, of course, this fireball is a gigantic bubble in the air. It's like 1% the density of air, so it's like a balloon. It doesn't have a surface around it to confine it. But what happens is the fireball starts to buoyantly rise. So you can get very large winds from the fireball as it buoyantly rises. This is how you get this toroidal motion. Because the fireball rises, the air around it is, or the edges is causing drag, so you get this rotating mushroom cloud like structure that everybody knows from almost birth when you think about nuclear weapons. So there are actually areas, if you were looking for ground damage in terms of, you know, let's say knock down telephone poles or debris or walls, where at certain ranges you'll actually find telephone poles and walls pointing toward the detonation point, because the shockwave came through, knocked down the structure, and then the buoyant afterwinds, which can be hundreds of miles per hour, start pulling things back in toward the center. It's just it's a technical detail. It's no relevance to you if you're in that close. You're already dead. Then, of course, you have the debris cloud. This is roughly the scale. And, of course, this is highly misleading because this area would be violently on fire. So if you were at this range from the nuclear detonation over downtown Boston, you would first experience, in relative silence, except for the sound of hissing gas as it burns out of, you know, so intensely lighting up surfaces, you would not experience a shockwave. Everything would start burning around you. Things would be caught on fire everywhere. Smoke would be everywhere from combustion. So you wouldn't, you know, for example, in cases where there were just big fire storm attacks, when you read accounts of this, as I have done, I wrote some papers on this earlier in my career, people are in the streets, they can't even read a sign. The visibility goes to zero. So you read these horrifying accounts of the of firemen in the streets trying to, they're overwhelmed, they don't know what's happening, and they're trying to figure out where they're gonna fight a fire. Of course, it's everywhere, and they can't even figure out where they are and where to go because they have no visibility. So you would not be able to see this giant cloud. And about 12 or 13 or 14 seconds later, the shockwave would arrive. At this range, at this particular range right here, the shockwave would essentially knock down every wood frame building that's around us. Wouldn't knock down a building like this. It might, for example, cause the outer wall facing toward the detonation point to collapse. And you might have extreme winds running through the building, but the building would not collapse on you. I doubt that you would consider that a necessarily a good outcome because, as my wife says, she wants to be at ground zero if this happens. She doesn't want to mess with all the details that follow. But in any case, this is what you're talking about from a single nuclear weapon. All right, so we're talking about one weapon, maybe launched in anger by a crew who feels that their country has been destroyed and somehow has gotten a launch code distributed to them earlier. Who knows? Nobody really knows. There's a lot of claims about what the Russians would do or what we would do. No one knows. Okay, just to give you a feel of scale again, this is a larger area, a picture from about 20 miles altitude of the Boston area. This shows you roughly the area that would be engulfed in a firestorm. No one's going to survive this. When you get a firestorm, when you get a fire on this scale, this is different from, let's say, the fire that burned down London or San Francisco or Chicago. There you had a fire that started someplace, people couldn't control it, the wind drove it, and it took hours and hours and hours and hours to cross large areas and destroy those areas. Plenty of time for people, unless they were very unlucky, to get out of the way. So you look at casualty numbers from these fires, they're not overwhelming. Damages, but not the casualties. But then, if you look at the firestorms, for example, from that occurred in Germany and Japan, they're completely different. These were intentionally set by the Allies to do as much damage as possible. And what the Allies did is they dropped incendiaries over large areas, which coalesced into a mass fire where pretty much everything around you was burning simultaneously. There wasn't a place that you could see where the fire was coming from and a place to retreat to. So you were in this fire zone. So that's what makes this different. Another thing that makes this different is that it's an enormous area simultaneously on fire. It's not a line of fires, it's an enormous area. So it has a tremendous buoyant pumping capability. It heats the air, it buoyantly rises, cooler air comes in from the sides, and you can get hurricane force winds at street level and air temperatures well over the boiling point of water. Nobody survives that. So if you thought you had a shelter, they'd find your toasted body in the shelter, which is in fact, when you study the consequences of firestorms on Germany, for example, where they had a very good sheltering system, they literally, after these fires occurred, they'd take bodies out and they'd be ashen. You'd see the bodies would have a shape of a human being, they would just be carbon. They'd take them outside and they'd just disintegrate from further interaction with the air. That's the kind of environment that it gets created. So, what do I do as a nuclear war fighter? And incidentally, I have seen this. Some of the early papers I wrote was talking about this, and it really infuriated some people, how would you target your weapons? Well, you're treating these weapons as if they're conventional weapons. So I'm ignoring the fact that these weapons have these fantastic effects at very large ranges, because I'm fighting a nuclear war. Now, when I fight a nuclear war, if I'm trying to go after what we politely call urban industrial targets, there are levels of damage that people want to inflict for military purposes. So for example, you have a dock facility here. You want to make sure that at least 200 pounds per square inch a blast occurs over this dock facility, because docks are, they're really rugged. They, you know, these are physically very strong structures. And if you want to knock them down or make them, at least from the point of view of blast, unused, of course they would be melted, but that's another, we ignore these effects. They're not reliable, according to the people who, incidentally, those of you who are really interested in this from a social science point of view, I suggest you strongly that you read a book written by Lynn Eden, one of my colleagues at Stanford, called Whole World on Fire. She did a wonderful job on this book. It's won a lot of prizes, actually. And how people get the mindset to do this. And so here you have these dock facilities. You put some weapons on them. There's an underwater tunnel. You want to impair the ability to move equipment because, you know, you're at war. So, you know, part of what you do at war is if you are fighting a conventional war, you see, this is the whole problem. You take these nuclear weapons, which are completely different from conventional weapons, in part because of scale, but for other reasons as well, and you treat them like they're just a conventional weapon. So with a conventional weapon, if I'm fighting a war with you, I'm going to try to make sure if I can destroy this tunnel. I don't want you moving equipment, munitions, stuff like that through it. I'm going to go after the bridges. And in fact, there would be many more targets. I just chose a few that people would all be familiar with here. So if you read some of the accounts of people who are trying to bring some sanity to this process, and let's say during the Eisenhower administration, when a lot of this was going on, it's gone on today continuously, of course, you'll read an account, I think George Kistiakowsky, or maybe George Rathjens at MIT, I think George might have, I remember reading a quote where they were talked about something like 20 or 30 or 50 weapons flying into Moscow. Of course, that was early. Now, I'm sure there are, you know, 50 or 100 weapons going in, you know, just to make sure you get every structure that these enemy could use for fighting and winning a nuclear war. All right, so this is almost a ridiculous question to ask at this point, but is it possible to find a way to nuclear war with Russia? Well, the key is you need the forces. So that's when I start talking about the nuclear force modernization program. You need the forces. What I need are nuclear forces that have sufficient accuracy and yield, combination of sufficient accuracy and yield, that I can destroy the critical targets that I believe I need to destroy to essentially neutralize Russia's ability to fight a nuclear war with me, or at least reduce their forces to a level that where I have superior, I have many more forces available, and thereby, according to this theory, much more freedom of action, as the story goes. So you have to define victory, of course, in this bizarre way of having more forces. And of course, you have to ignore the secondary consequences. Secondary consequences are not simply the destruction of the adversary's society, which could be an afterthought with less than 1% of the forces that were left. But there's secondary effects, like, for example, we now know, and this is not fiction anymore, not science fiction, that there are consequences for the global atmosphere. There could be enough smoke put into the atmosphere from combustion of the cities to cause changes in the global surface temperature. Now, it doesn't have to be nuclear winter, if you have questions about that. It only has to lower the temperature a few degrees on the average for a few years, because there's not going to be adequate agriculture to support billions and billions of people who are already on the edge. So that effect alone, disregarding the essentially complete destruction of the Northern Hemisphere, which would occur by those means and other, those effects and others, would be a secondary outcome of this war. So it is a problematic situation. But again, what's going on in the mind of the Russian military analyst? The Russian military analyst sees the Americans taking all these steps that clearly and unambiguously appear like they're building the forces to have an option to fight and win a nuclear force, a nuclear war, by actually, you know, trying to destroy Russia's nuclear forces. Now, so what you do matters. All right, so you first have to have the forces, but there are other things that you need. For example, if I am going to destroy the adversary's forces, we call this damage limiting. If you're in the Pentagon, they call this damage limiting. We got to do damage limiting. I wish I could tell you some anecdotes because I had some great times at some of these briefings. You really want to do certain things. So for example, you want to destroy the adversary's forces on the ground. Now, very large fractions of these forces are ICBMs and aircraft. In order to stop these ICBMs and aircraft from flying against you, you've got to destroy them before they're launched. You might have some missile defenses, I'll discuss that shortly. But even the most maniacal advocates for missile defense don't claim that they can deal with thousands of warheads from a country like Russia. So you must be able to execute an efficient first strike. This requires, first of all, that you go first. It also requires that if you can do anything you can to disrupt the early warning system of the adversary, that could lead to delaying the adversary taking action, thereby increasing your chance of catching those forces on the ground, you're going to do that. So here you are, the military planner in Russia, and you're looking at these bizarre activities, and you're asking yourself, what do these people think they're doing? You know, what are they up to? I was through this situation myself, personally in many situations. I was intensely involved in reviewing the Moscow ABM system. And I'm looking at this system and I could see that it was a joke. We could defeat it so easily it wasn't worth any effort at all. We had no effort at all to defeat it. And yet, it really worried me because I said, what do these people think? Do these people think this is actually help them? Does it mean that they will take certain actions if we have a standoff or a crisis that could precipitate an unwanted nuclear exchange? So the psychological component and the social component of this is critical in understanding how the technology gets viewed when it's assessed with a cold technical eye and then put into the political and human context. So you want the ability to destroy or completely eliminate, if you could, the early warning capability of the adversary. And it'd be nice to have some missile defenses too. Because the missile defenses are a good idea because you can't get everything, even if you're intensely ahead of the adversary. So, you know, if there's some stuff that's squeaking back at you, like the warhead coming at Boston, you'd like to be able to intercept it. So let's look at the United States now. We're earnestly trying to increase the killing power of our nuclear warheads, improving the accuracy and thereby the ability to destroy the hardest of targets, the hardest of Russian targets. We are we have known for not quite 20 years, maybe, that the Russian early warning system does not have satellites as part of, they do not have a working space-based component. Incidentally, this was discovered at MIT by my group. At that time, I still had intelligence clearances, and so I went to the Pentagon and briefed these people about it, not because I was trying to, because I was saying, look how dangerous this is for us. And basically, they took the information, thanked me, and then just went about their business like nothing was of concern. So today, for the last 20 years, the Russians are sitting with an inadequate early warning system, and we're poking them as hard as we can every time we try. And of course, we have earnestly building the weapons to for a preemptive attack, whether or not we truly intend to do that. And of course, a preemptive attack will depend critically on taking advantage of weaknesses in their early warning system. So it does look like a potentially serious situation if you're a Russian military planner. And if you go and look for remarks made by Vladimir Putin, who is pretty knowledgeable from a military point of view, whatever one thinks of other things about him, you'll actually see actual comments about from him from time to time that indicate that he clearly understands that these actions by the United States indicate this kind of intent. So whether it's true or not, again, it doesn't matter. It's a problem. Okay, so let me show you. I'm just going to give you some examples to put some meat on the situation. Let me start out by just showing you some what I call points of instability. All right, the Russians do not have a space-based early warning system. Now, this is an amazing fact because it's very hard to understand why they have not developed that technology. And I have lectures on this subject, not lectures. We now know, I would say for sure, that this is the case. We even had a meeting in London last year where, I mean, the Russians went berserk when I brought this up in Moscow for the first time. But you can understand why, if someone told you, if you were trying to hide the fact that you didn't have an adequate early warning system, that's a significant military secret. And so they were very unhappy when I started trying to talk about it. Now, the reason I was trying to talk about it was I was trying to get it out on the table so we could start talking between the Clinton administration at that time and Russia about what measures could be taken by both countries to reduce the chances of an accident that would destroy both countries. You know, it's in our interest that these guys don't attack us by accident, you know? So when I go to those characters in the Pentagon and you look at them and hear them talking, you should ask yourself, what is the priority of these people in the Pentagon if they don't think that this is important? So that right away, there are lots of things. I mean, if you look at the foreign policy of the United States in general, if I were sitting down and saying, how could I screw up the situation as badly as I could, I would pretty much be doing what we're now doing, if that was my intent. So it's hard to understand how people could be so limited in their understanding of alternative approaches. But I can tell you from personal experience, these people in the Pentagon, they just don't care. They look at you like, you want to give them help? No, I'm helping myself. I'm keeping my country and myself alive. So I can't go into much detail about this, but I can give you a feel for it. We have these remarkable systems. This is a dated slide. It points to a system called the Defense Support Program satellites. We are now replacing those with a space-based infrared system. And these satellites, basically, they do the simple thing in appearance of just looking down at the Earth and seeing missiles when they're launched. Now, this on the surface looks like a simple problem, but it's a fantastically difficult problem. Think of yourself as trying to see a lighted match that's a few kilometers off the surface of the sun while in the visible. The intense light background, the background is so intense, you will not be able to distinguish that there's anything different from the light coming from that area that you're looking at. So the problem of the subtracting the background is a gigantic technical problem, which the United States solved. And so we were able to look straight down. The Russians did not have the technology to do it. They understand. I remember sitting in an organization called Kamieta, which builds the early warning satellites for Russia, and having a young engineer explain to me in detail how our satellites worked, and it was really an extraordinary detail. This guy So they understand what to do, how to do it, or what to do. They don't have the engineering base. They don't have the base, the ability to build the kinds of devices you need to do that. So they did something very clever, totally inadequate, but very clever for what was available to them. They have a satellite system called the Molniya system. So really, nothing works when it's right. The Molniya system is a constellation of 9 satellites spaced out in these highly eccentric 12-hour orbits. And for 2.5 hours each, one of them is at apogee, moving slowly enough, and it looks down at the Earth edge. And it tries to see rockets against the black background of space. So that's the way that system works. The Molniya system is not fully populated now, so there are, it's absolutely predictable when they can't tell what's going on from American ICBMs. But it looks like they are in the process of reconstituting that system after roughly a decade or more of not working with it. But they also had another system they were talking about. Never got built, although there were some satellites launched, called Prognos. And Prognos was, again, how Prognos worked was discovered by my group at MIT, again. When I went in to look at the intelligence documents in support of the Clinton administration's claims they were going to try to do some cooperative things with the Russians, the intelligence documents showed nothing. They had no idea how this system worked. In fact, when I read these intelligence documents, if I didn't know what I knew when I started reading them, I would have been misled. So that's how bad. So when you worry about intelligence, you know, Mr. Clapper, you know, or incidentally, if you want to make your case about not letting these guys get into your iPhones, just put up a picture of Michael Hayden in your home, and with a figure, do you want this guy in your bedroom? You know, these are not people who really are high quality necessarily, and they are not people who necessarily respect the principles that our country has been built upon. So we're in real danger now, in my view. And all this craziness, we have a security problem, but it's just gone berserk. And the people who want all this extra access are the people who help maneuver us into the position we're currently in. So it's quite an interesting situation. So how does Prognos work? Doesn't work as the intelligence documents would have told you. It works by Earth limb viewing. So the Prognos 1 satellite sits directly over the Atlantic. It's in what's called the geosynchronous orbit. This is an orbit that's at high enough altitude that the satellite rotates once every 24 hours. So from that altitude, about 40,000 kilometers, it appears to be stationary in the sky. So it looks at one part of the United States, the northern tier of the United States. It's an additional satellite to the Molniya satellites, which are coming around and looking at the top down at the Earth. Part of the reason for that was there was an accident, a false alert, I think it was in 1983 or 84, where it appeared like there was a massive rocket launch from the United States toward Russia. And the Russians had to stand that down. And fortunately, they're much more careful than they are portrayed to be. Russians are actually quite cautious with regard to nuclear weapons. Thank goodness. So they started launching the Molniya satellite and putting it into an orbit over the Atlantic, so they'd be looking from 2 different directions, because we know the sunlight was coming in from this direction at the time. We know the time of the accident, and it looks like there was a reflection off cloud tops that was seen by the Molniya satellite that was in position that would be unlikely to happen to be seen by both satellites. So that's what the Russians sometimes called dual surveillance. There's a Prognos 8 that's never been launched. They've only launched 4 of these positions. we've only occupied four of these positions. Today, none of these positions are occupied. And they've given up. In fact, we know when these satellites are launched, but I know for a fact from conversations with people really in the know. And I don't think this was, they understand they have a problem, and they did exactly what I would have done in their situation. They said, we don't have the technology to implement this important system. So rather than squander vast amounts of money on a system that's totally inadequate, we should work on our radars. And the Russians have built a very, very elaborate, more robust radar system than they had earlier, and they continue to upgrade it, because that's all they can do. Radars are line of sight, though. Okay, so notice a couple of important things. Because you just only have so many satellites you can launch, it appears that the Russians did not choose to launch two additional satellites to try to cover parts of the North Atlantic. That's where our submarines operate, in the Atlantic Fleet of Submarines. On the West Coast, it looks like they did have the Prognos 6 and 7 satellites, which were never launched. They were planning to look at the Gulf of Alaska, where the Pacific Trident Force operates. Now, if you want to ask, why here but not there? Well, there was a radar at Krasnoyarsk in the 1980s, for those of you who follow these things, that was supposed to check to monitor the corridor into European Russia to see attacks from the Pacific Trident Force. And it turned out to be in violation of the ABM treaty, and we forced the Russians to pull it down. No thinking ahead at all about what this could mean if they accidentally, they were wrong, incidentally, I want to be very clear. They should have gone to the United States, talked about this problem, negotiated something consistent with the provisions in the ABM treaty. I think they made a grave mistake. But because they make a grave mistake doesn't mean you should follow it with something even more stupid. So anyway, this was certainly because they didn't think that they could cover that corridor. So basically, we know everything fits together. Even if you were James Clapper, you might be able to figure it out. And the big problem that the Russians are worried about is a submarine-launched ballistic missile attack against their nuclear forces. Now, why submarine-launched ballistic missiles? Everybody knows they're less accurate. Well, that's not true. Turns out the most accurate ballistic missile forces we have are on submarines. They are more accurate than the Minuteman missiles we have. And if MX, this ultra-accurate missile, were in fact ultimately deployed, although it failed, they would be more accurate than MX. That's how good submarine inertial guidance has done. So these are, now the good thing about submarines, at least from an argument that I honestly believe, is they're hidden in the ocean. If you can't find them, there's nothing to shoot at. So you don't have an incentive to strike at the adversary. However, if they pose a major short warning attack to the adversary, because the adversary is vulnerable, is asymmetric in some sense, is vulnerable to these kinds of missiles, that's a real problem. So the pluses associated with submarine basing of missiles are offset by negatives. How you balance that is a discussion that it would be hard to resolve, but it's certainly worth having. And so this just shows you potential trajectories where you could be attacking, I think this is Moscow in the case of this slide. So, to make things clear, if I launched a submarine-launched ballistic missile from this northern part of the Atlantic shown here, I would not begin to know about it if I were Russian until about, this would be maybe 2.5 minutes, because this doesn't include powered flight. So if you launch 2.5 minutes, 3.5, 4.5, maybe 5 minutes into the flight, I would know that something very bad may be happening. And in this particular trajectory, it had 9 minutes before the warhead came in and hit. So, I'm sorry?
It's just saying 5 p.m.
I'm sorry?
Letting you know the time.
Oh, time, okay. This is a clock there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, wave at me. I know this is going longer than it. So the bottom line is, without this space-based infrared, you could not tell that activity was going on in the Atlantic. And this is what led to a false alert in 1995 that caused us at MIT to analyze it. Again, the US intelligence community hadn't done its job, as seems to be usual, at least in my experience. We discovered what actually happened. In the process of discovering what actually happened, we asked the question, well, why didn't the Russian infrared early warning system see it? And then we started looking at the satellites, and we said, what the hell is this going on here? They have 8 satellites, in these weird places. Why not just put a single satellite up over the Atlantic and look down? And that's when it started to become clear that they didn't have the technology to do it. A very interesting story about, I have a little lecture I give. It's the dog that didn't bark, I call it. That's what led us to this conclusion. All right, so now what's going on is the U.S. Modernization Program is dramatically increasing the hard target kill capability of submarine launched ballistic missiles. We, because of accidents of history and just plain economic limits, have two kinds of warheads on our submarines. One is a warhead that is nearly half a megaton in yield. It's known as the W88. It's got a yield of 475 kilotons. It could be 700 the yields are, the consequences of these weapons do not strongly change with the yield. But it's a big weapon, basically a half megaton weapon. We have about 400 of these weapons that were built that are deployed on our submarines. We have about 2,100 kiloton nuclear weapons. Now, these weapons may be as accurate as the 475 kiloton warhead, but the yield is lower, so the range of lethal effects is smaller. So until, let's say, the last 5 or 6 or 8 years ago, these weapons were not qualified, this is in quotes, for use against the very hard targets in Russia, because they just didn't have the combination of yield and accuracy. Well, it turns out there's a very clever thing you can do. You can put, instead of a regular fuse in the warhead, what I call a super fuse. So I call it a super fuse, the conventional fuse and the super fuse. If you want to look up the patents on these, which you can find on the web, one, it's called a burst height compensating fuse. This is the engineer's way of describing this. Or a path length integrating fuse. It's a super fuse. That's the way to think of it, because that's what the consequences of this device are. Okay, so our target is something like a big Russian silo-based missile. This missile is about 100 feet, 10 stories large, tall in length. It's in a very highly protected structure. It's on springs and all kinds of systems to limit the shock. When the air slap from a nuclear weapon nearby propagates over the structure, the whole structure will move. Lots of engineering has gone into thinking about making this missile, making it able to survive a nuclear attack by the United States. So what the United States does is we have an assessment of the hardness of this target. It's a bureaucratic mechanism. We call it damage criteria. So the damage criteria, I don't know what I'll describe what this is doing, so you can make your own judgments about the damage criteria. The damage criteria for a target like this is about 10,000 pounds per square inch hard. I'll show you later. The Russians clearly don't think of their own, just as we don't think of our own silos as we rate our own silos as 2,000 PSI hard, pounds per square inch hard. The Russians, we know from documents that have been analyzed by a very brilliant scholar who's in the West here, Pavel Podvig, they think their silos are 1,500 pounds per square inch, which I think, you know, they're reasonable guesses. You can never test on them adequately. But 10,000 pounds per square inch hard is absurd. But that's what qualifies these. So from the American point of view, these 2,100 kiloton submarine launch ballistic missiles qualify for attacking these targets. Well, what does that mean? It means that all these higher yield warheads that you have on ICBMs and on the other submarine launch ballistic missiles now can be used for other missions. Your force is just expanded. In fact, when you do the arithmetic, I'll show you a few curves just for purposes of intimidation. You would need three of these warheads with the conventional fuse to do the same, to have the same chance of destroying a target as one of these same warheads with just the new fuse. So that's a pretty, you've tripled the size of 2,000, of the effectiveness of 2,000 of your warheads. Think about what this means for future arms reductions. The Russians are gonna just treat this like it's not a problem? All right, so here's what a conventional fuse does. You come in 25 or 30 degrees relative to horizontal. You have an intended aim point, so that's where I'm trying to hit. But there's a distribution. It's generally assumed, and this is a good rough approximation, that there's roughly about a 300-foot miss distance on the ground, as defined as the distance on the ground where you, on the average, will miss. This is what's called a CEP, for those of you a little. It's just the range at which half of the warheads fall within that circle and the other half of the warheads fall out of it. It's just another way of calling it a standard deviation. It's a very simple, but you don't need to worry about this. All right, so the accuracy, the CEP, is about 100 meters. And you see, of course, as these warheads come in, some of them are going to fall outside this volume, where if one of these warheads blows up, you'll get at least 10,000 pounds per square inch on the ground. So you can, you know, sum up what falls within this volume, or, you know, on the ground here, and divide that by the number of weapons you would expect, you know, the number of weapons that would fall outside, the total number of weapons, you get a probability of kill. There are much more sophisticated ways of doing it. Total nonsense. There's so many details we don't understand that are fundamentally not knowable, that this technique is as good or better than any of the more fancy techniques that people have. So don't let somebody bamboozle you. So what does the superfuse do? The superfuse detonates, it's a burst height compensating fuse. It changes its burst height, and it changes the distance at which a burst of a given altitude occurs in order to place all the warheads inside this volume. It's very effective in this particular case because the spread, the accuracy of the incoming warheads is very close to the projected area of the volume, the lethal volume that you see. So it turns out that all you do, notice that the aim point is no longer here. I've actually shifted my aim point downrange. That's because I can not only capture the warheads that overfly, I can include warheads that would underfly and land outside. So what the superfuse does is say, okay, I'm shooting at this target here, I'm gonna shoot a little bit above. And it's like a basketball player who lofts the ball up against the backboard to get it in, to have a higher chance of putting the ball in. So, very, very simple idea. How it works, it takes an update from outside. I won't get into that. This is too general a talk for doing it. It's a subject area, though, that has been getting a lot of attention at this moment. And I'm working on a paper now with the people in Washington to alert the what's happened now? To alert people to what we're actually seeing. This has all been classified, incidentally. You now know what the government has been trying to hide from you. All right. I don't know what is happening here. Sorry. All right. Let's. Let me show you quantitatively how this changes the picture. We need not work. Here is the rough accuracy of estimated accuracy of submarine launched ballistic missile warheads. And this is the probability of kill if you have a roughly 300 foot CEP with a conventional fuse. But if I use the super fuse, 0.9 or better. We're going to win. And we're going to free up a lot of warheads for other applications. Now, I'm working half blind here, so. A bureaucratic issue that has profound consequences for the psychological, for the tensions and potential instabilities introduced by this innovative technology. We think we treat these silos as 10,000. These warheads now qualify, you know, in a bureaucratic sense. I can sit in my basement in Omaha, and now no one's going to tell me you can't use that warhead on this target. So big advance from the point of view of the target here. But the Russians almost certainly think their silos are less than 2,000 pounds per square inch hard. So when they look down the barrel of the gun from the other end, what do they assess the situation to be? This is, again, trivial asymmetry of warfare, but not necessarily one that people keep in mind. Here's what the probabilities look like to them. We already had a 0.85 probability with those warheads, but we weren't going to target them on them, although that's can always change your mind. They have no way of knowing. But now the probability is 0.99. And I have heard Russians say that we don't expect our force to survive if the U.S. succeeds in a first strike. One shouldn't gloat when you hear that kind of thing, because you can be sure they're doing what they can to make the possibility of that first strike as unlikely as possible. Now, one of the things they can do, the only thing they can do, is recognize their early warning system is not up to the job and pre-delegate authority or do some kind of pre-delegation procedure. People seem to think they know what it is. I don't believe it. I don't think we know. I don't believe many Russians know. We had pre-delegation procedures when I was in the Pentagon, and they changed with the president and the situation. And it was one of the most highly protected secrets. And if you knew it at one time, you wouldn't know it again at a later time. And so the idea that we know what they would do, but let me tell you, you know it's not going to be good. You know it's not going to reduce the chances of something very bad happening. OK, so what about the tremendous increase in the killing power of these warheads? What does it mean? What might you do with all these other warheads? Well, one thing you might do is you might use the larger warheads to go after command centers. Some of these command centers are deeply buried. When we deeply bury a command center because we're concerned about maintaining some form of continuity of leadership, we're the good guys. When the Russians do it, they're aggressive. They're bad guys. So what the Russians are looking at is, this is the crater from a 475 kiloton, a large ICBM. And to give you a sense of size, this is the Capitol building. So I'm assuming the Capitol building is a command center that's roughly 100, 300 feet underground. You can see, for this thing to have a chance of surviving, it's going to have to be well deeper than that. And so when somebody tells you, oh, the Russians, they got these tunnels under the Kremlin, they're thousands of feet below the ground, they're paranoid. They're not paranoid. They're looking at the facts of the situation. And of course, the problem is how could political leadership communicate with anybody after this command center has been hit, even if they survive? I don't know the answer to that question, but I'm sure they've been thinking about it. So somebody is going to have priority, you know, have the authority to take action, depending on whether or not communication is available to the remaining Russian forces. I'm just going to make two comments here. I have much more to talk about, and it's obviously getting late and probably tiring to the audience. There are some other things that we're now doing that are very serious. First of all, there's constant inflation of the threats. And these threat inflation, some of it, you might argue, is truly debatable. Other pieces of this inflation are absolutely unambiguously false. So when the American Secretary of Defense, a Harvard scholar, tells you that the launch of this satellite launch vehicle is a precursor, that this satellite launch vehicle that the North Koreans just launched could be turned into an ICBM, he either doesn't know what he's talking about or he's lying. I know Ash very well. I have my own judgments. I won't say what they are. But at a minimum, it's a false technical statement. There's been extensive analysis. We now have a very complete picture of what technology the North Koreans are using in their satellite launch vehicle. The South Koreans obtained, after the launch in 2012, I think it was December of 2012, the first stage of this vehicle fell into the LOC intact, and the South Koreans grabbed it. And they were fully willing to share everything. We have photographs of all the different motor components, the pumps. We discovered there were some vernier rocket motors that we hadn't considered in our analysis. We know how the airframes are built. We know they're made of high-strength aircraft aluminum. We know that there's stringers. You know, we have pictures of the stringers inside them. So we can really build a model of this rocket. This rocket will never be an ICBM. Definition. Look at it. Everything's definition. It will never have the ability to carry a one-ton payload to the mainland of the United States. It could carry a one-ton payload maybe to other shorter ranges, but not to the United States. So this is not a threat to the mainland of the United States. There are variants of this rocket that you could build, and we have I just finished an extensive study of this, that where you could use the technology that's in this rocket to build a larger vehicle that could deliver a one-ton payload. One ton is the magic number associated with what people think a first-generation workable nuclear weapon might be. So the technologies could produce such a weapon, a rocket, but I think a conservative guess is they would be 10 years building this new rocket, given the rates of construction they've so far demonstrated they can do. Remember, this is a country, it's not a matter of how smart they are. In fact, I actually think they're very clever. And they know a lot more about rockets than I think people realize. And I've been talking about this as much as I can to people. It's a big mistake to assume that these guys don't know what they're doing. They have a very poor industrial base to work with. That's a big limitation, and that's important. If they try to build a new rocket, I don't say they will or won't, we would be able to watch them doing things for 10 years easily as they did it. They have to test new clusters of engines. They have to build very big airframes. We would be able to see all that essentially from the beginning of the project. So, and if you want a missile defense that would work against that, I can tell you about one that would. And it would not threaten China and Russia, but it would be very intimidating against North Korea. The other thing they're doing, and I'll stop, I see my little signal's going, is the United States is in the process. We first saw an article in the New York Times today. It's a national crisis in South Korea. The United States is trying to put a THAAD missile defense battery into South Korea. The THAAD is a system called the theater, no, it's not theater, it used to be theater high altitude, it's terminal high altitude area defense. Names keeps changing to protect the guilty. The radar itself, the THAAD missile system, as I've demonstrated, it's now been a big, we've run on the front page of a very important South Korean newspaper now for the last month, 6 months. They've been publishing our critiques of this system. Anybody who's interested, I have the English translations of the articles. We can show using basic physics that the THAAD system has no chance of providing a defense for South Korea. All the claims about it being a second tier that would work, nonsense, not true. In this recent launch, the North Koreans demonstrated that they know exactly how to defeat the THAAD. What they did is they took the first stage of the satellite launch vehicle that they were launching, and they cut it up into 270 pieces. 270 is the number we got from the South Korean government before they shut their mouth about everything. And the reason for that was they wanted to deny the South Korean government the opportunity to pick up another rocket stage and have more intelligence on their capabilities. But as was pointed out in a front page article about our analysis, this is exactly what you would need to do to defeat THAAD. Because what you would do is after a rocket completed its powered flight, so this is the first stage is not going to go anywhere, it's just going to fall pieces into the LOC. But after the rocket is going to get to its target, you cut it into a bunch of pieces, and the infrared homing sensor on the THAAD vehicle can't tell a piece of tumbling rocket motor from a warhead. Just sees a point of light in the sky. So it has to wait so long, it has to wait for the atmosphere to cause these other objects to slow up before it can be launched. And we showed in detail that the altitude would be too low for the THAAD interceptor to even get off the ground to the engagement envelope, QED. And so now the South Koreans know that THAAD will not protect them. But the Chinese have gone berserk over this. This is a very serious national crisis. The Chinese look at the THAAD radar, and they see that the THAAD radar is a very powerful radar, much more powerful than is needed for a regional, a very local defense of the kind that the South Koreans want to do. So this radar can be used to watch ICBMs that are launched from China toward the United States below the Earth horizon, below the horizon where the United States could see with its own radars the oncoming ICBMs. We could see their launch, but we would not have details of their trajectories. This radar could get details of these trajectories and cue a radar called the LRDR, the Long Range Discrimination Radar, which is in Clear Alaska, cue that radar to look at the horizon exactly where these warheads are going to come over, giving it the maximum time to try to tell the difference between warheads and decoys. Now, I don't think this is going to work. But if you're the Chinese military planner, this looks unambiguously like the United States is aiming its national missile defense toward China. We say we're not going to do it. You know, we're good guys. You know, take my word for it. But for some bizarre reason, the Chinese just don't think our word is quite so great. In fact, I think a lot of our allies now are somewhat concerned about our word. And so this is escalating. The Chinese, I think, made a strategic blunder. And I've said this to my South Korean colleagues. I mean, I'm not going to defend the Chinese. They were very threatening in their statements toward South Korea. I mean, South Korea is really in a bind. The North is really a dangerous country. We really don't know what these guys might or might not do. And it's easy to talk about it when you're sitting here in the United States, but if you're in South Korea and your family's there, it's not an easy subject to ignore. So I have great sympathy for the circumstance of the South Korean people. But the missile defense is not going to add to their defensive capabilities. South Korea's largest trading partner now is China. That happened in a few years. They have been trying to normalize relations. East Asia is a tinderbox waiting to go up. And we're stoking it. We, the United States, are stoking it every way we can. If my objective was to create a very tense relationship in East Asia, I'd be doing exactly what Mr. Carter is now doing from the Pentagon. And it's hard to believe, it's just hard to believe that people can be so short-sighted. But I know these people, so I can tell you that I do believe it because I've seen it firsthand. Let me stop here. I'm sorry I've gone on so long, but I hope it's been of some help to you.
Thanks so much. So it's already somewhat later than we expected, but I don't know if you have time for more Q&A.
I can talk, but I know people have other